So let's do the refuge on page 8, refuge in bodhicitta. In Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Spiritual Community, we go for refuge until fully enlightened. By the power of all six perfections, from generosity to non-dual wisdom, for the sake of all beings, may we realize Buddhahood. So take a moment to get comfortable with the body. You might wish to just let awareness move through the body, scan it, just see if there are any areas of tension that you can relax and release. And then you might want to take some slow, deep breaths. Breathing in, and then just letting go on the exhale. Breathing in, and letting go. Breathing in, and letting go. And already you've learned one of the secrets of relaxation, that relaxation isn't something we do, it's something we allow. And now just let's take three more breaths and just let a sound escape on the out-breath. So breathing in. Breathing in. Breathing in. And now allow your awareness to be open to the full sphere of experience. Degrees open awareness. So that now instead of the mind being in the body is in the mind. The body is in awareness. And awareness has no boundaries, but for the sake of practice, it can be useful to imagine awareness expanding out. So now, take an in-breath, and on the out-breath, imagine the air leaving your nostrils and going out to the farthest reaches of the universe, and let your awareness expand with that breath. Follow your breath out. Let your awareness follow the breath out to the farthest reaches of the universe. And as things arise in the mind, thoughts, feelings, fantasies, images, just let them be there. Just let them arise and pass away. Just enjoy the fact that you don't have to do anything. You don't have to struggle with or even change any experience. Letting things be as they are, being aware of things as they are, and aware that you're aware. In every moment of experience, there's awareness. You can't see it or touch it or grasp it in any way, but you can know it. You can know it by relaxing and being it. and relax. And whenever you wake up out of a moment of fantasy or thought, you can just start again. Or if you wish, you can just take a moment to be grateful for the awakening, enjoy the awakening, and then just relax with awareness. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the changes and transformations and that practice fosters, which are really some of the reasons that we practice, and then look a little more closely at something I spoke about last night, which was the way in which we can use spiritual reading of very small amounts of text as a reflective meditative practice. Not something we want to do a lot of on this retreat, but something which can be a very valuable practice, in fact is a key practice if done appropriately, and can be useful on retreat in small amounts. So why then do we practice? Well, of course, there are all sorts of answers to this. You know, each of us has our own, and each of us has our own unique aspirations and vision of possibilities. And we spoke about that some last night. One way of looking at reasons for practice is a very simple threefold division. And that is that spiritual practice produces a transformation in us. It produces realization, and it enhances our capacity to our very multiple capacities, but particularly the capacity to contribute. So those are three key reasons to practice: for the transformation and healing that occurs, for the realization and awakening that it fosters, and in order to be better able to contribute and serve to others. So clearly, spiritual practices are designed to transform us. They're designed to shift and heal and make whole and enhance both body and mind, and heart, particularly mind and heart. Now we can look at the kinds of transformation in various ways. But essentially, spiritual practice, an authentic, well-rounded spiritual practice, such as the Eightfold Path, affects a transformation in practically all parts of the psyche. It shifts motivation away from the egocentric motivation, which is often a dominant theme of the untrained mind and heart, to a more altruistic and other-centered motivation. It shifts it from material things to more subtle things, and ultimately beyond all things. And it reduces attachment and craving. It fosters emotional maturity as a second major kind of transformation, the reduction of unskillful, painful emotions, fear and anger, rage, hatred, jealousy. And it fosters positive emotions, emotions of love and compassion and joy. And along with that, also fosters a kind of equanimity that, in the face of emotional experiences and powerful experiences of all kind. Then practice is both based on and leads to a transformation in ethics. As we practice, we just come to see how painful it is to act unethically. And we move to be more ethical, both as a, not as a sacrifice, but out of enlightened self-interest. And practice clearly refines perception. It allows us a greater precision and clarity, and also leads to spiritual vision, a recognition of the sacred in all things and all people. It fosters concentration, a stability of mind, rather than the incessant distractibility and promiscuity of attention that we usually suffer from. And these culminate in deep insight into the nature of the mind, into the nature of reality, and that insight in its turn culminates in wisdom. And then finally, as all these qualities find their consummation and expression in service and contribution to others, we just increasingly recognize that acting for ourselves alone really creates a tension, contraction, separation, and suffering. And service moves from sacrifice to, again, to enlightened self-interest. So those are the kinds of transformation that ensue with spiritual practice in general and with this practice we're doing in particular here. But there's something more than that that these practices aim for. And that's not just a transformation, but a kind of transcendence or a realization or recognition, a recognition of who and what we really are. And that's it's a shift in identity. This is a shift from, as we practice more and more, we see that we've been identified with a very small part of our mind. We've been identified with a particular subset of thoughts and images and emotions, which we take to be me. And we've basically mistaken ourselves for a self-concept or a self-image. In fact, we and practically everyone in our culture assumes we are our self-concept. It's very interesting. You think what self-concept means. It's actually a concept, an idea about ourself. It's not who we really are. And what we increasingly recognize as we practice is that we've identified with a very small aspect of the psyche, and often not a terribly happy part at that. Our self-concept, self-image is often tied up with the mistakes and errors and foolishness that we did in earlier parts of life, the ways we were hurt, etc. And effectively binding us to the past. And as we begin to see this, as we begin to explore and recognize what we've taken ourselves to be, increasingly that self-concept or self-image goes from something we are looking from, that which we're identified with and looking from, and to something we can look at. And when we can look at something, when we're mindful of it or aware of it, we're no longer identified with it. We no longer presume it to be us. So one way of thinking of what we're doing is, as we rest in awareness and allow mental phenomena to pass through, sometimes we get lost into them, but at other times we are able simply to witness them. And that which we can witness has no power over us. That which we witness, we do not assume to be ourselves. And increasingly, as we do this practice, we begin to recognize that what we are is actually the awareness or Rigpa that is doing the observing. So so increasingly, as we do this practice, there's just this subtle but increasingly pervasive shift in the presumption of who we are. And increasingly, there's just this, at first, very vague sense, but then an increasingly grounded sense of being more the awareness which is witnessing rather than that which is being witnessed. And in moments of real clarity and awareness. We experience ourselves as that awareness, unmediated by any mental content. That is, our sense of identity is no longer mediated or created by thoughts and images and fantasies, the mental phenomena that arise. And this is a very radical shift, because it moves us from being victims to being witnesses of our minds. It moves us from the sense of perpetual struggle and effort and suffering that comes from identifying with a limited, constricted, false self-sense to freedom, a sense of being free of that, what had been a lifetime struggle. Now, the exact relationship between transformation and realization is somewhat mysterious. Transformation, we practice, and the transformations that ensue kind of lay a ground or a foundation for realization, although the realization itself can occur at any moment. There's a wonderful saying attributed to Baker Roshi. So enlightenment is an accident. Meditation makes you accident prone. So how do we make ourselves accident prone? Well, we do these practices. And what practices are essential? Well, basically one needs a well-rounded, integrated set of practices that complement and foster one another. And that's basically what the Eightfold Path or the Vajrayana path is. In fact, the Vajrayana is probably, in my looking at world spiritual traditions, the Vajrayana is probably that has the richest set of practices of any tradition I've ever found. So we can think of these as the Eightfold Path, or we can think of them as the Rushon Trekchud Togyal that Lama Surya was talking about this morning. Or we can also think of, for example, Lama Surya's six building blocks: the daily spiritual practice, study and inquiry, inner growth work, group practice, teacher practice, and service. So part of that is the reading and study, and especially reading the words of those people who have woken up. But there's one thing that's really important to recognize, and I'm sure you all have, but it's worth expanding on, and that is, and actually Lama Surya touched on this morning, that when we hear spiritual messages, when we read a profound spiritual text, we get it at different levels. We get it at the level we're capable of hearing it at. Because what we see, what we can recognize, is a function of our own maturity. And as we read a spiritual text, or even just brief things like the refuge — I've been chanting refuges for 30 years and it's still opening and getting deeper. As we do that, then different levels of meaning become unveiled for us. And there are various ways of describing these levels, but in the Dzogchen tradition, it's sometimes spoken of as outer, inner, secret, and innermost or non-dual, those four levels. In the Western, particularly Christian, but also philosophical tradition, one speaks of reading texts at a literal level, at a moral level, that is, taking them as moral injunctions, at an allegorical level, which is more the mythic or metaphorical level, and at the unitive level. So it's interesting, and I could give other examples from different traditions, but the bottom line is clear that one can read texts at very, very different in very, very different ways at different levels. And this has enormous implications. This is not some mere theoretical idea. This has great importance for us and our relationships and our spiritual practice and for the culture and world at large. If you look around at the at our culture and the world, a lot of the world's strife is caused by people reading spiritual texts at different levels. Really? Really? And for people who only read texts at the mythic level and of course, filter them through their own perspective, then this can be very dangerous. So part of our practice is to open ourselves to successively deeper levels of spiritual texts and teachings. And I'm talking about texts here, but actually this also applies, and actually I probably should be emphasizing more, this applies just as much to teachings. And many of you will get, for example, the tapes of Lama Surya's talks from this retreat and listen to them again, and probably in 6 months and a year they'll sound, oh, where was I when I heard this? That's a sign of a really deep teaching, that you can keep hearing it at successively deeper levels. There's a story that illustrates the different depths of meaning that are effectively buried or hidden from us if we're not what's called adequate to them. Imagine an animal finding a funny black and white object which smells funny and tastes terrible. The animal spits it out. And then someone from an illiterate tribal culture finds it and finds, a woman finds this very curious object, which is dark and white with marks on it, and it opens and closes. And being a very, very smart woman, she soon discovers it's very, very useful. It's wonderful for starting fires. And then a kid from a literate culture finds it, and it's a book, but since he can't read, it doesn't mean anything to him. And then an adult finds it and opens it and starts reading, but it is quite ridiculous. It makes totally ridiculous statements about the nature of reality and throws it away. And the physicist opens it and finds it's a profound text on quantum mechanics. And then a person who's a physicist and a contemplative opens it and finds it, yes, it's a profound text on quantum mechanics, and it's actually written by, it actually doesn't appreciate the empty nature of all phenomena that it's describing. Now, the interesting thing about this is that everyone was right. The animal was right. It was a lousy tasting object. The woman from the tribal culture was right. It was great for starting fires. The kid was right. It was a book. The adult was right. It was a book, but was wrong in appreciating in being unable to appreciate its depth. And the physicist was right. Now, what's doubly interesting is that at each of our developmental stages, there may be information and messages that are going over our head, and we do not pick up the cues that they're there. Okay? So it's easy to overlook the deeper meanings. Now, when we're listening to a spiritual talk or a profound talk or reading something, a profound text, then often there are clues because there are ideas that sound very profound to us, and there are other ideas that sound nonsensical. And I have found it a very good indicator that if I'm hearing a mix of what sounds like profound and nonsensical, it may be saying more about my limits than about the speaker or about the text. So How then do we open ourselves to these deeper levels of meaning? How do we effectively read or listen to teachings as a practice? Well, we usually listen to lectures or read texts for information. But here we're not after information so much as we're after transformation and realization. And the general principles of working with teachings are fairly simple, at least in outline. And it's interesting, across different traditions, one finds the same message. In our Buddhist tradition, there are three stages. It's first listening, shravana. Then it's reflection, which we were talking about last night, the conscious use of the intellect to examine and inquire. And then meditation, letting go of the intellectual analysis and simply allowing words or ideas to resonate, to work their effects on our hearts and mind. Sometimes there's another division, and that is, we find that particularly in the Christian tradition, where they speak of lectio, which is reading, reflection, and then what they call oratio, which is letting the emotional responses arise. And finally, the contemplative listening or hearing in a deep, non-thinking way. So how do we do this? How do we work with this? Well, in a talk, we can't control the rate at which things are coming at us, but when we're reading, certainly we can, and the emphasis is on very slow reading of small amounts of text. Then the reflection is simply a relaxed, it can be a couple of things. It can be either just a relaxed letting the mind think about, or it can be more a focused inquiry. So you read a line and then you just stop and really focus attention on that sentence and what it means. And at this reflection stage, it can be helpful just to allow thoughts and associations to arise spontaneously. And there may be insights and understandings, and there may also be images that come up. Images that relate to what you read, or images that reflect your state of mind. So you can just allow these to be too. So so then, if we read, say, something like, and you can do this with something you're very familiar with. For example, let's take this refuge in bodhicitta on page 8. Let me just invite you to take a couple of minutes or more to just read this very slowly, a few words at a time, and let this sink in. So if we look at this, if we look, the first line, first sentence in Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Spiritual Community, we go for refuge until fully enlightened. So we're going for refuge in the Buddha. Well, what's the Buddha? Are we taking refuge in a little Indian man who lived and woke up and died 2,500 years ago? Are we taking refuge in our spiritual teachers? Or are we turning for assistance to anyone who's awake? Or are we recognizing that we can rest in and take refuge in the pure awareness or Rigpa or Dharmakaya that the Buddha woke up to? Or are we taking refuge in the entire universe, which is also the manifest form of what people awaken to as their identity? Or is the Buddha that we're taking refuge in the awareness that is looking out from your eyes and reading the refuge? And is the Buddha sitting on your meditation cushion hearing these words now? These are very different things to take refuge in. That's the first two words of this refuge. Okay. And my own experience in doing this is literally these successive levels have opened up over years of practice. But we can foster that process by bringing conscious awareness and investigation to the reading and chanting that we do. And it's very easy to just recite these, you know, as a kind of automatic thing at the beginning or end of a session. But what I want to point to is the possibility that by really just opening to this, it can unveil different levels of meaning and implication for us. Now, that's the insight part of the practice of listening or reading spiritual messages. There's also the emotional side. So when you read this, if like me, you may be aware of various emotional responses. By the power of all six perfections, I actually just like, when I'm doing this myself, just to mentally list the different perfections, six of them, because each of them, just to say each, actually evokes that quality of mind. So by the power of all six perfections, from generosity, ethics, zeal or effort, forbearance, concentration, and transcendental wisdom. Just to say them evokes something. And when you've reflected on these ideas enough, just to say them actually begins to evoke the qualities and the corresponding emotions. For the sake of all beings, may we attain Buddhahood. For the sake of all beings, for me, it has such a wonderful feeling. That's an unlimited goal or aspiration. It has no limits. It has no constriction. It's a boundless ideal. It just has an exquisite feel to it. So in reading or in listening to teachings, we have these emotional responses. And they also can be extremely valuable. So as emotional responses arise, as we're hearing a teaching or reading, we have a choice. We can simply be aware of them, allow them to rise and pass, which may be totally appropriate. In one time, another occasion, it may be appropriate to turn attention to the emotion. And if it feels appropriate to turn attention, then to focus on the emotion, to immerse yourself in it, knowing that there's something really wonderful about awareness, that one of the characteristics of awareness and of mindfulness, when we direct awareness to something, is that it has a beneficially transformative effect on emotions. If you turn attention to and are mindful of positive emotions, they increase. They tend to strengthen and be reinforced. If you turn attention to painful negative emotions, they tend to unfold and release and self-liberate as free energy, often with corresponding insights. So the emotions that arise in hearing a teaching or listen or reading can be mined. They too have their gifts to offer. So let me suggest you again read The Refuge in Bodhicitta, this time just being aware of any emotions that arise as you do. So we listen, we reflect, we feel. And then there's also the possibility of simply opening beyond the intellect to these teachings. There's the possibility of contemplative prajna being the direct seeing and the wisdom that results therefrom. It's a transrational direct intuition. So when you're reading a text like this, or hearing a talk, you may notice that there are times when the mind stops. You know, a really powerful idea. You hear Lama Surya talking, there's a powerful idea that hits you, the mind stops. Or you're reading something like this, there's a moment of just stopping, mental activity stopping. That's an opening. That's a moment of clear awareness. And if we're not alert to it, alert to this possibility, we may not notice it, we may not appreciate it. We may, if we're reading, reactivate the mind by starting reading again. But actually, that stopping is a moment of, can be a moment of real opening. In that moment, you can simply rest in that open, clear mind or awareness, and this becomes structured practice. And some texts are written from this place of pure awareness, of naked awareness. These are so-called definitive texts or final teachings, as opposed to provisional texts and expedient teachings. So most teachings are what are called expedient or provisional, but there are some so-called final teachings or definitive texts. And in those cases, we're getting a kind of direct mind-to-mind transmission from someone who is resting as clear awareness. Well, with these texts, it really is a, and these teachings, when we're lucky enough to hear a teaching like that or find a text, it really is a transmission that's going on. Actually, there's transmission at all these levels, but this is a real transmission of awareness. One of my favorite authors is Longchen Chenpa, extraordinary 14th century Tibetan genius, spiritual and intellectual genius, really one of the major figures in Tibetan Buddhism. And he wrote an enormous amount, of which we have a significant number, but not all of his texts. One of the most distilled of them all is this little book, The Basic Space of Phenomena. And it begins with these words. Just be with this. This is direct transmission. Naturally occurring timeless awareness, which is utterly lucid, awakened mind, is something marvelous and superb, primordially and spontaneously present. It is the treasure from which comes the universe of possibilities, whether of samsara or nirvana. Homage to that unwavering state, free of elaboration. That's where that guy was coming from. Any comments or questions? He just goes on and on and on. About, I'd say, 50% goes over my head, but there's no way I can pretend that that's not my problem. So, comments, questions?
If it's so important to, at least in the readings and the teachings, to sit in the emotions, the bodily sensations, why don't we do it in the Dzogchen practice? Why do we just, or it seems from what I've picked up so far, maybe I've missed something, the importance of reflecting and then coming to real knowing by breaking down things through the emotions.
Let's see. First off, you mentioned body sensations, and I didn't. So thank you for that, because of course there's wisdom in the body, and I will probably plagiarize you then if I give this talk again. Thank you. The body, yes, as my wife says, one of my jobs is to remind you have a body. Okay. But since she's not here, that didn't get mentioned. Okay, so yes. So thank you for that. So there can be teachings and wisdom in all experience. And part of the practice we're doing is opening to all experience. But the tractate practice per se is about, it's actually a kind of final stage teaching and practice. It is fostering the capacity to rest in and be awareness, which is not entangled in experience. Usually awareness is entangled in and identified with experience. Okay. So one can say that all spiritual practices have as an aspiration the disentangling and disidentification of awareness from experience. Dzogchen kind of starts at the end and aims to help us practice to recognize that awareness and then increasingly identify from and live from that awareness disentangled from mind. Now that doesn't mean at all that we can't also take times when we directly focus attention and investigate or explore all the domains of experience. And actually, you know, keep in mind that the Dzogchen practice is actually embedded in the Vajrayana tradition, which has enormous numbers of practices for exploring body and emotions and mind in a myriad of ways. But each practice has a particular focus or direction, and this awareness practice is more about cultivating that capacity for being resting as awareness. Now, again, by all means, at other times, use that clarity of awareness to investigate experience in more active, focused ways. They're complementary. Yeah, thank you.
Riffing off that last question makes me think about what we consider emotion and what we recognize when bodily sensation manifests. So I'm just wondering about contemplative prajna, you know, just prajna as a manifestation of recognition. I think someone was speaking about asking about recognition earlier. So I'm just wondering about the the essence of the nature of mind pointing out where this shunya, we could recognize its shunya nature, its clarity. And the third one is this interesting unobstructedness. Which I've also often wondered, it's sort of like transcendent emotion. I mean, it's not sort of, sometimes it's translated as compassion, or you get this ultimate bodhicitta translation for what we're touching into. So I just wonder if there's, if you could say something about, a little bit more on, you know, how we recognize prajna or, you know, insight. I guess sometimes it's more clarity, more like an understanding clarity, but sometimes it seems like it could be something more like, that scriptures refer to a body witness,
I'm sorry, what was that?
The scriptures refer to the body witness as another way of, you know, recognizing truth or... So I just wonder if there's an aspect of that that's not normal, you know, sort of emotion as we think of it, but sensation on a different level or something. The sensation of wisdom, I suppose. Do you have any comments on that? I'm more of a body-based type, so.
You're what?
I'm more of a body-based type.
Let's see. Well, there's a lot in that, so I'll just take a couple of strands. Just first off, just so we're on the same roadmap with everyone. Prajna is the term referring essentially to wisdom, and particularly the kind of direct seeing, the wisdom that comes from direct seeing into the nature of reality, not so much the intellectual discursive thinking about. Now there are phases when one sees directly and then has wisdom which can get articulated and refined by the intellect into thoughts and ideas and even whole philosophical systems. As to a kind of body-based wisdom, I think maybe the strand to follow here is that as we practice and as we gain greater trust in ourselves and our minds and our experience, we recognize more and more that there is wisdom embodied in our experience, that our minds generate experiences which are valuable and appropriate for us and our stage and our path. And the part of the practice is learning to listen more deeply or feel more deeply into our experience, into the body, into emotions. And as we feel deeply into these, as we experience them sensitively and defenselessly, then they tend to unfold and evolve in beneficial, healing, transformative, and even and self-liberating ways. So I guess, you know, one theme that just to take off from what you're saying is just to again emphasize the inherent wisdom of the psyche and of our experience, and to and the value, once again, of trust. There's a line in the Third Zen Patriarch, a very profound little, very brief little text. The way is one with the trusting mind. Does that speak to some of what you were raising?
Yeah. I guess image I had when you said that there's inherent wisdom is something like if we wake up in that moment of just an experience, it's any experience can be a pointing out instruction, pointing us back to the nature of mind. Like that's
Nice. Thank you.
I'm trying to compare this method of reading, I guess. I was taught that if you have contact with any information on first contact, you're going to get about 14% of it. And if you were exposed to if you heard one tape six times, you'd possibly have 60% retention. So that's one of the things I've liked about the recent series of videos, the 4-minute videos he's put on YouTube. You know, I've been able to watch the second one he's put out there, and it's kind of like what we've talked about. I mean, I've watched it enough. I knew there was something more the first time I watched it. I've watched it, you know, every morning after I meditate, I watch it. and it's very deep. So I was just wondering about the multiple hit method as opposed to slow method that you've talked about.
I don't see them as different. You can, you know, I was talking about specifically ticks being slow, but obviously one comes back to them. Multiple hits, yes, that's one of the, you just described one of the characteristics of deep teachings, that you go back to them and you hear more and you see if, and it continues to unfold and unveil itself to you. So I think you just gave a great description of what happens with a deep teaching, by all means. And again, the guideline is our own innate wisdom. Does it feel appropriate to go back to this and listen? As long as it feels, you know, as long as you feel, as you listen deeply to yourself and feel pulled to go back and listen again, wonderful. Yeah. Okay, we're about coming to the end of our time here. So, let's take a moment to just recognize what a rare gift it is to be able to explore the Dharma and the questions of life and the ways in which we can cultivate beneficent qualities and heal and help ourselves and others. So let's just take a moment to cultivate gratitude for this opportunity of being together. We couldn't do this if it weren't for each of us. If you hadn't come, we wouldn't be able to have a retreat. So let's take a moment to be grateful to each other, to be grateful for the opportunity of exploring in this way, and to be grateful for the fact that when we leave here, we'll be able to be a little more help to people, to relieve suffering a little better, to spread more joy more effectively, and to help heal and awaken others, and hopefully to benefit people, all those we touch in very subtle ways, and from them, through a ripple effect, hopefully to touch other generations as well. What a gift, so much to be grateful for.